Humanity. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, or maybe it's the middle of the night wherever you are. We are broadcasting from beautiful, sunny southern India in Auroville. Welcome, welcome, welcome. And Pramit, I would love to welcome you to the show. You have been living in Germany. You got your PhD at Bonn University in Germany. And I'm so excited about this show because we are going to talk about science and data and healthcare and how it all comes together. And you, to me, are like the total genius. So welcome to the show and welcome back to India.
Thank you, Faith. Absolute pleasure to be here. Lovely to be back in sunny Auroville. And what an amazing time it has been here. So very happy to be here. And hello, everybody. Hello, hello.
Okay, so one of the things that really fascinates me and excites me, actually, is how you use data and data science and healthcare, and you bring it together for all sorts of things. Could you maybe explain a little bit about what you are doing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So data is one of the things that lends itself to almost any field, which is the beauty. It's extremely transferable. And I actually have a background in the sciences. I studied computational sciences and I was a programmer. So I always wanted applications of data, of programming in real life. And how much more real can it get than healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. So I decided to get into pharma and healthcare. And I had the good luck of working with a digital health platform that was an incubator. So I was working all across the healthcare spectrum, just helping digitalize conventional healthcare. So you had applications like minimally invasive treatments, you had apps, you had devices, you had digital midwives, you had everything you could think of. You had biotechnology companies.
Digital midwives, did you say?
Yes, that's indeed what I did say.
Digital midwives.
Yes.
Okay, just very briefly, can you tell us about a digital midwife?
It's exactly how it sounds. It's a digital midwife. So the company is called Kinderhelden. It's a German company. They were one of our venture companies, and we were basically digitally transforming their services. So what they do is they build apps, they build products that will basically tie up with insurance companies and guide women through their pregnancy. Basically replacing almost to a large extent, almost entirely, a real midwife.
Oh, but you don't have the touch. I mean, I think what we love is to be able to have that beautiful touch. I mean, an app can't really touch you.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Which is why I stressed on the almost entirely part.
Okay.
You do need people, but there are a lot of things that can be automated. Like, you have to do this kind of test, you have to do that, check this, check that. This is the kind of feeding that you have to do. Ah. All of this can really be automated. And if you put this into a device, people can really take care of themselves and educate themselves about what they need to do. It also empowers people. They're not dependent on other people so much.
So you're talking about empowerment. And before we get further into this, the other thing that I think quite, not I think, I know really excites me is the fact that you have done some things with Muna. And Muna is with AVI Germany, Auroville International Germany. Mm-hmm. And she works very closely with the Wellwurz volunteers that mm-hmm. have come here. In fact, we have also had our volunteers. So before we launch right in, I would love to hear how you supported them and mentored them, because we have a lot of youth in Auroville and a few of them are actually in Germany and are looking for mentors. So how can we link some of that? We'll get into that a little later, mm-hmm. but I just want to place that on the table now so you can address some of that. Yeah.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure meeting Muna. Muna is in Berlin, where I'm based, and she's basically working for Auroville International, mm-hmm. very passionate person, mm-hmm. loves Auroville, very influenced, and she talks to volunteers and persuades them, encourages them, motivates them to come and spend time here in Auroville.
What is it that you did with them? Because we're quite familiar with
Wellwurz. So she wanted me, as a native Indian, based here, grew up very close to Auroville in Chennai, also in Pondicherry, wanted an insider perspective from me. So what she did was she arranged a session where I would actually talk to them, find out what they want to do, and give them my view on how living in Auroville would be. So questions went all across the spectrum from what kind of clothing they would be expected to wear to how much money they would get here in Auroville, what is the value of money, so how much could they get with what. So basically all kinds of questions pertaining to living in Auroville. And depending on their age group, they asked different questions, which is something I found interesting. Being a data guy, the youngsters, of course, asked more about money, more about things like that. The more elderly among them asked about consciousness, about shift in, you know, the cultural mindset that they need to bring about to sort of integrate here better. It was very interesting talking to them and seeing how they view living here. It was interesting for them, I'm sure, but very interesting for me too.
So when you're talking about the age range, you're saying younger and older, mm-hmm. but it's still youth.
Absolutely, absolutely. But youth is a generalization.
So what was the age range then about...
I think the youngest among them were, like you said, 18-ish, early 20s is what mm-hmm, I felt. Mm-hmm. And the more elderly in that group, of course, were in their mid-30s, I felt.
Really?
Yeah.
Mid-30s,
yeah. There was one pretty elderly couple, very sweet, very interesting to talk to. They've been to Auroville before. They seem to know a lot about, you know, living here, but they asked very interesting questions as well. They asked about the kind of, you know, the mindset that we grew up with in India, what would allow them to really sort of, you know, vibe in here and not just live here as a foreigner. So what I really sensed was their attempt or their interest in really understanding the cultural atmosphere. And this is something that I found magical, because this is something that a lot of us don't do when we are in foreign land. We don't bother to really soak in the culture of the place before we are actually there. And some of us don't even bother to soak in the culture even after we are there. And this was amazing, trying to understand the whole setup before actually even venturing out. I felt it was really good.
So one of the things that you're talking about is how you're fitting into the culture. So how is it that you have been able to fit into the German culture being a young Indian man, yeah, mm-hmm. and doing your PhD there? And how long have you been there in Germany?
Mm-hmm. So I've been there for 6 years now. Time
wow.
flies. Yeah.
Wow.
I
wow.
went there at the end of 2015 to do my PhD. Finished my PhD in Bonn in computational sciences, and then moved to Berlin to work, and I've lived there ever since. As for integrating, for me, it was a little easier because I went as a student, and Bonn is a city with a very, very, very heavy student life. It's a student city. The Bonn University is one of the oldest universities in Germany, very famous. So that probably made it a little easier for me. But basically, it was about understanding how Germans work, how Germans think. They love their own language. They love their culture. And if you show interest in this kind of a setup, they will welcome you. And I like languages. And and the German language is very logical, so it was easy for me to pick up. And this worked like a charm. And before I knew it, you know, I was liked, I felt integrated. And then moving to Berlin was actually quite the shock, because Berlin is, not like your any other German city. It's a city that has people from all over the world. So it feels like London, New York, or any other metropolitan city. In fact, many Germans say, are you in Germany or are you in Berlin? Please specify, because they view the two very differently.
Okay.
So moving from Bonn to Berlin was actually a little bit of a transition in that respect, because I had grown quite used to this little sleepy university town where you meet familiar people, where you're in your bubble. Overall, it's been a very enjoyable and enlightening journey.
And you are also mentoring students.
Mm-hmm.
And can you tell us a bit about that? And can our Auroville youth, how can they plug into that? And what is that mentoring about?
Absolutely. So I mentor with this academy called Freedom Employability Academy. They were mm-hmm. formerly called Freedom English Academy, because there was this emphasis on teaching people business English, not because there's anything sacrosanct about English, but simply because it is viewed as a gateway to global professional opportunities by many. And so they had this, but then they realized that calling it Freedom English Academy is not realistic. So they made it Freedom Employability Academy. And that is what they are now called. They are FEA. They're a huge chain. They grew small in the beginning, but then they grew and grew, and now they're international. So what they do is they look for volunteers all over the world so that they get multiple cultural perspectives, multiple professional perspectives, and then they assign students to these mentors on a rolling basis so that the students throughout their time, throughout their schooling, get access and exposure to different professional circles, different cultural circles, and then they grow. So they spend about 3 to 4 months with each mentor. And on a weekly basis, they spend time in small groups so that you actually have, a direct interchange, exchange of ideas. And we talk about our goals, aspirations, and then they ask questions about, the journey. What did you do? What would you do if I were you? Or the other way around. So basically getting perspective into their everyday life. This is what they try to do. So I'm struggling with this. And what was interesting for me is struggles can be very different. Struggles don't always have to be financial. So, there were people battling mental health. There were people battling other circumstances. Some had learning difficulties, but their families were just not in the right place to accept this. And so they wanted perspective, from a neutral source. Mm-hmm. Very interesting to see all the difficulties that our youth go through, but don't often get the right guidance on. And so what FEA tries to do is, instead of pinning one person, as responsible for this, they try to make this connection. So
beautiful.
So the youth can find, what they like by talking to a number of people.
So our youth right now are going through a lot of trauma. There's been a lot of things that have come into Oroville. We've had JCBs come in the middle of the night, basically rooting up trees at youth center and other areas. And it came as a shock. And not only the youth, but the entire community right now is dealing with this aftershock.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very traumatic for all of us. Mm. How do you see this data science? And is there even a way of supporting it? Maybe not in Oroville, but have you heard of something that happens in a global sphere?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. So firstly, I'm very sorry to hear about this. Grew up near Oroville, big fan of Oroville, big fan of the community spirit. So I can completely understand. But on that note, there is an entire community called Data Science for Social Good. They're an international community as well, where they actually have volunteers and employees who are data science practitioners. Some are into machine learning, some are into artificial intelligence, and there are others who are data analysts and data scientists, data engineers, who work on applications that have a direct social impact. And one of their projects is actually concerning peace, be it at a local level, community level, or a global level. And applications could range from understanding public behavior, predicting when there would be protests, riots, uprisings, by the way people are behaving, either in terms of, them clustering, or the kind of communication on social media, or the kind of language they use. Sentiment analysis is a big field here. So some sort of prediction, some sort of insight into how the tide is evolving, so to speak, because there are usually indicators before which conflict happens. So the aim here is to read into that data a little bit.
What you're saying is so important, and some of our listeners are not English speakers. Mm-hmm. So if you don't mind just speaking just a little slower, I think that would be great.
Absolutely, absolutely. With pleasure, with pleasure.
And just repeat a little bit of that, because I think it's very critical. What you're talking about is that prediction, that possibility of that prediction, and how does that work?
So what I can tell you is that the people have ways of expressing their sentiments, be it social media, be it in texts, be it in groups. So there are characteristic traits of human behavior that often exhibit themselves before conflict takes place at a global level or even at a noticeable level. So usually it's quite possible to understand that people aren't really happy with the way things are going on. Sentiment analysis is just one. But if you look at behavioral studies and use that as a data source, it could be possible to actually predict what people are feeling, how groups are getting alienated and what they're really unhappy about by looking at their feed. For example, you can very easily scrape and see what is the, you know, thing that's most commonly talked about. How are people feeling? I'll give you one example that is also very pertinent mm-hmm. to our present scenario. When COVID first happened, people wanted to understand how public was reacting to mm-hmm. the lockdown measures. So what they did was they started looking at Twitter feeds, they started looking at Instagram feeds, because that's where people are most honest. And so then they started checking and looking for patterns in their choice of words, which would give them an insight into what they're actually feeling. And that is how they figured out that, you know, some people took it seriously, others not so much, who they would have to target to actually get across the point that we need to isolate, that we need to keep distance from each other so that we all make it safe out of this pandemic.
So when you're talking about patterns of speech, are you able to give us an example?
Absolutely. So the most famous example is about how a lot of speech detection algorithms often use bad language, pick up bad language. That, I think, is the most telling example, because all algorithms based on machine learning learn from the data that they are exposed to. So what is usually done here is you give them a pool of words, you give them text strings, you give them feeds, and then the algorithm learns to map word choices with moods. So a typically trained algorithm would be able to tell you that this person is angry based on their word choice, or sad based on their word choice. And the better you train your algorithm, the more accurate it gets. It could tell you that a person is neutral, or that a person is vindictive, for instance. And this could already be a very initial indicator of where all of this is going. Because it's rare that people wake up one day and say, okay, let's have conflict. Usually it brews over time. And this is where data science could come in.
So, for example, like if you've got different perspectives, mm-hmm. right? You've got 3, 4, 5 different perspectives, and each of them is neutral in their perspective, but very adamant. And they're not using bad language, or both are using bad language. How do you determine that level of violence or that level of anger? Because some of it is subtext, or some of it, perhaps people aren't speaking in that same way with the bad language.
Mm-hmm. So what I can tell you is that usually before this conflict, there is a difference in opinion about something. So what algorithms could do is pick up on these differences in opinion. So say, in the simplest case, somebody is pro something and somebody is not.
Yes.
So you could easily cluster people into these two groups and then figure out that one community is growing over the other, and there are more people who are splitting themselves into either of these communities as against just being neutral. This is something that an algorithm could easily pick up on in a community, particularly if you have some data source. Social media feed is just one example, but any sort of communication channel that is being monitored could be used as a data pool.
So once you have all this data, is there a possibility to resolve, or how do you move towards conflict management and dealing with this conflict in a healthy way? Is that possible?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there have been successful applications of data science where this has been done, where people have often figured out when is the right time to actually communicate about a certain thing, who to communicate to, because usually there are certain features that are more important than others. So there are certain people who are more difficult to convince than others. There are also certain people who are more easily provoked than others. So these patterns can be identified, and with the right intervention at the right time, it can often help in resolving matters peacefully.
That sounds wonderful. Sorry, I'm going a little off track, but sometimes I think it sounds like, you know, in India, when people get married, you read your horoscope and, mm-hmm. you know, or not the horoscope, but the astrology. And, you know, on this day, at this time, with this person, in this place, right? Is that, I'm being a little ignorant here, but is that almost the same as the data science?
except that instead of relying on chance, we have algorithm data and mathematics that this is trained on. But in principle, it is the same thing. Do you leave it to chance or do you leave it to chance with a little bit of an educated guess? Uh-huh. An educated guess is basically what machine learning and data science is about, which was going to be my next point. Can we always succeed? Absolutely not. Do we get it wrong? Absolutely, yes. But do we get it wrong all the time? No. Hopefully, you'd get it right more often than wrong with these methods, because you're looking at data and trying to model a new phenomenon as a function of phenomena in the past.
So when we're looking at conflict internationally, you know, with Syria, with Afghanistan, with a number of places, mm-hmm. has this been used there and has it had any effect there?
It's usually used as an ongoing sort of tool to understand how the situation evolves, more to do a postmortem insight than to actually prevent it or reverse what happened, because that is not realistic. But yes, there have been lots and lots of analysis that have been carried out. And even now, there are ongoing studies that volunteers are doing to really understand as part of, you know, social data science projects.
So there is a strong healing component, mm-hmm. a very strong healing component, even though we're dealing with data science and machinery and artificial intelligence, that's coming into a heart space. I'm having a little bit of a hard time understanding this.
No, absolutely. Bring the human back into AI is an ongoing project in Berlin as well. Because, yes, of course, the empathy factor is something that you cannot have through data or through machine learning mm-hmm. or through artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. which is why a question that often comes up is, can artificial intelligence replace doctors, bankers? The truth is, it can't replace anybody, because human empathy cannot be replaced. So, which is also why with job filtering algorithms, for instance, an algorithm could tell you that this candidate is the perfect candidate, but is it the perfect candidate that always gets hired? Perfect on paper, matching all the criteria? No. Sometimes you just interview somebody and you like them. And that like them is something that AI cannot account for. That is something that you just feel. Mm-hmm. That is human.
So in Oroville, one of the things that we're dealing with is we don't have a higher education that's here. We don't have a university directly in Oroville. There are many people that we have that are going to the Netherlands, they're going to Germany, they're going internationally. So we're looking at when our kids, our children of Oroville go there, is this, how do they get into this field? Or is this something that can start here and there is a partnership where we can send them over? Or how does this work?
I think that, as with anything, there are more routes than one into this. Mm-hmm. I can only speak for myself. Mm-hmm. I entered this field through my education. So I did a master's in computational sciences and then, of course, chose the best group for my PhD. So the group that I really liked. And that is how I went there. But yes, there are exchange programs for people who are into programming, talented youngsters. There are exchange programs that allow them to come and carry out internships. I've seen volunteer programs as well, where people can come, spend some time. They get boarding and lodging in return, and they can spend some time working on some data science applications for a social cause. And these programs can often be a gateway into the field, because you're doing something that's meaningful at a societal level, but also getting really good at your professional data science skills, professional coding skills.
Beautiful. And so, again, someone who's done engineering, is that can they go into this? Because here in India, I'm discovering that most of the kids go through medicine or engineering. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like the number one thing, right? Or the one and two things. So is that the gateway into doing the master's program and then going into this?
Until recently, this was almost exclusively the route into the world of software, data programming. You had people from the sciences, you had people from engineering, and you had people from slightly peripheral fields, if not directly these fields. But now, data is the most egalitarian space you can imagine. I have colleagues who are musicians. I had an ex-colleague who was a photographer and at one point decided that he just wants to learn coding, loved it, wanted to make an impact with it, and then decided to work for the healthcare company where I was working.
And does he use the music or the photography within the data science field, or is that completely separate?
Well, he was sticking to photography as a hobby and working in the healthcare space as a job. But of course, as it is with most serious hobbies, he was also writing programs with image recognition to sort of train models to pick up on his photographs. So he was actually using an algorithm to classify his photographs. So he had natural beauty, something else, different categories of photographs. And he was just playing around with his hobby. Of photography and merging it with his more serious professional undertaking.
You know, we talk about things being a hobby and then it becomes a profession. So, for example, with clowning, right? I mean, it became a profession in hospitals 35, 36 years ago, 1985. So it's the same thing. It's like before that, people were going in, they weren't being paid. But now what we are doing, and this is how I actually met you, right?
Exactly.
At a breakfast. And we start to talk about each of our interests. And this is what connected us, was that even though it was initially a hobby or something that you love to do, or I love to do, it soon became a profession. Now, I just want to change gears a little bit, if I may. So with what we do, people think it's just all about laughter and ha ha ho ho and entertaining. But there's a deeper element to what we do in terms of laughter, happiness, changing the mindset, refocusing where you are, and transforming your cells, you know, as the way some scientists are doing. We're talking about Dr. Joe Dispenza, you know, Dr. Greg Braden, Dr. Bruce Lipton. Joe Lipton, they're all becoming one. So how do you see medical clowning and clowning as a profession and supporting what's happening worldwide with mental health and other things? How does data science support that?
Mm-hmm. Before I answer your question, let me say that I'm also a huge Bruce Lipton fan. Bruce Lipton spoke at a conference recently, and I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled. He merges science and spirituality.
Yes.
I am a scientist by training, and simply seeing that these fields can merge and that they are, you know, compatible with each other is amazing. Yeah. Big Bruce Lipton fan. Well, I think that clowning is as integral a part of healthcare and medicine as any other, because I volunteer in the hospice space as well, where we are providing moral support and emotional support to people who have been discarded by their parents. These are typically terminally ill people, elderly people. And what I have seen is that very often just some company, just knowing that somebody is around you, somebody is here to brighten your day, can go a long, long way, because usually they're already into well-placed healthcare systems where their medical needs are taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
But this doesn't necessarily mean that they are feeling loved, that they are feeling valued. And just knowing that there is somebody who cares about me, I've seen their faces light up when I visit them. And that makes my day, because I realize that, you know, all this effort now in traveling is now worth it, because I've made somebody so happy by just going there. It was also a learning experience for me. Sometimes my own friends, my family, of course, they're very happy to see me, but you don't see that kind of unconditional joy that you often see in a person who's, who doesn't have proper memory, or who has dementia, or is just terminally ill and has nobody to, look after them. So I would say the same for clowning. I think bringing some joy into people's lives is an integral component of healing or even palliative care. Just knowing that they have something to enjoy, even if it's short-lived, even if it's temporary.
Oh, no, very, very much so. In fact, I have been with a number of people as they've left their body, you know, be it children, right from the age of, I think, 1 month.
Mm.
I think the youngest was 1 month, to people that were into their late 90s, where the clown, my clown character, has been requested by them and the family to be there and to feel that heartbeat as that heartbeat just goes. And it's really an amazing and a beautiful feeling to go through that. And Here again, is there other ways that we can start to monitor the laughter? How do we take clowning seriously? Because it's not taken seriously. It is more so now in the medical field, but how can it be taken more so using data science?
Mm-hmm. So the company that I was working with before I switched jobs, the healthcare firm that I spoke of, had one partner venture which was into making apps that would monitor people's health, mental health. And so these devices would actually try and pick up on indicators of distress, of depression, of panic, or just unhappiness. And this company in particular targeted graduate students, but it did lead me to the thought that this could be generalized. And then when I did a quick search, I found that there are people who are actually marketing these applications by looking at body signals. So just as you would have apps that would monitor your heart rate, that would count the number of steps that you're walking, what if you had an app that could actually tell you that, hey, you're stressed, hey, you're panicky, take care of yourself, or more importantly, tell others, be it your therapist, be it your psychiatrist, or be it your medi-clown, that this is what I need. Because sometimes they cannot tell you, or even if they could, they wouldn't want to tell you, mental health being such a taboo topic and such a controversial space, people are often not ready to tell you, but what if you could pick up on it? And yeah. There are devices that are in the market, and there are efforts going on, of course, to understand this better.
Well, it's very interesting because when I was working in the hospital in Canada, I have not worked so much in the hospital here because of the whole COVID situation, but I've worked with smaller groups. But the psychiatrist and the psychologist would call the medi-clown in because we're completely at the bottom of the totem pole, completely, right? So there was... people would feel comfortable to say to us, you know what? I wanted to slip my wrist. You know what? I had a whole bottle of pills. You know what? Life totally sucks. Mm. And we would journey with them. And sometimes it got to the point where the psychiatrist in an emergency situation, the clown was brought in and we would almost intervene. Like, you know, if you weren't able to say that you had taken a bottle of pills, I was able to bring that out in my clown character, able to bring that out. So then it became a whole team effort. And that was really quite magical to be included in the team in that way, because a kid's not going to say to someone, hey, man, this is what I did. It's like, you know, they just like bad word language, right? And this is it. Yeah. So, but this was really wonderful to be able to be part of that team. Yeah.
Well, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And be acknowledged as part of the team because it's a much needed addition. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think in Germany, you have the Klinik Clowns, right? Mm-hmm. You have Theodora, you have other clown organizations. Mm-hmm. And we're just really developing that here with MediClown Academy. Mm-hmm. I was one of the people that was in Canada. In fact, in Canada and United States, they started doing clowning in hospitals around the same time in 1986. As a paid profession. So we've come a long ways. We've come a long ways. And now we're looking at what is the education. You know, we have one guy who's got his PhD in medical clowning and he's in Israel. You know? So that's fantastic. And one of our board members, in fact, is from Israel and he launched that program. Now tell me, is there something else that you can share with us that you would love to share with us and share with the youth here? And at the end, I'll put your blog down so people can get in touch with you.
Well, I would just say follow your passion, do what you like, and let things happen. That's the best advice that I can give you. Don't make everything scripted. life is not a program that everything has to go according to plan because programs never do. Neither does life. But hey, do check out my blog. That's always a good idea. And if you'd like to write for Amicable Scientists, that's what I've called my multi-author science communication platform. I say my, but it's actually our because it's a team effort. And everybody who writes gets featured either as part of the team if they write regularly or as a guest if that's what they would like. I would be really happy to hear from you. You can also check out my personal blog, which is Academic Techie. I moved on to becoming a techie from academia, so I'm the Academic Techie, academictechie.com. Do check me out, get in touch, say hello. I'd be very happy to hear from you.
Well, what excites me too is when I first met you, I thought, wow, this guy is so wise. He's got so much there. And then I found out how old you were. And this was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. You were 27. This guy is 27. He is now 29. Just blew my mind. So you are a youth. So we've got youth supporting and mentoring youth. And I love the fact that we've got the Oroville, Bonn, Berlin connection. We've got the India-Germany connection. And it's all coming together. It's totally coming together. And let's see how we can devise, we can have peace. We can support each other with peace. We can support each other in terms of finding work opportunities, mentoring opportunities, everything that's there.
Absolutely. Humanity is one big community. We have to remember that. Yes, absolutely.
And one of the things that we do at the end of a show is we laugh. Because, I have to ask you, how does laughter and happiness help your mental factor?
It really helps. With data science or without, it really, really helps.
Okay, well, I know it helps without, but tell us how it helps with.
Well, you can of course have these devices and look at the signals that you can see when people's mood changes. Mm. I actually did one study, so I will mention that shortly before we wrap up, where somebody who was studying signals in the brain put electrodes on my head and made me do some tests. The tests were very simple coordination testing, and she was actually studying the signals that were coming out from my brain. Later to do some data science analysis and link this to autistic behavior or not. So they wanted some control group data as well, which is why they had me in, and they were looking to see how people were reacting to certain kinds of stimulus. And so I saw that there are very characteristic signals when somebody is zoning out, when somebody is distracted, when somebody is falling asleep, somebody is pretending to pay attention but is actually looking at something else. And she said, this is when you fell asleep. And I'm like, how do you know? Do you have cameras? And she said, no, look at the signals. And so I learned that whenever there's a certain stimulus triggered in the brain, this can easily be tracked. Not my domain, so I don't want to talk too much about it because I'm not aware of the particulars, but yes, it can be done. And once you've got those signals, then it becomes a data science problem to understand how often, what is triggering what, and how is this affecting the overall setup, overall health space.
Wow, this is so exciting because you can also use it in relationships, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's child-parent, children-children, sibling-sibling, husband-wife, any type of relationship. So it's individual relationships, and we're coming back to this, but it's like the two camps or the three camps of how can we bring peace together, you know, by predicting or looking at some of those predictions.
Absolutely.
Wow. Absolutely beautiful. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that you want to add?
No, I would just wish you peace, wish you happiness, follow your dreams, stay happy, and greetings to everybody.
Thank you. And what we do at the end is we laugh, because when it changes the vibration in our body, it changes the vibration in our heart, in our mind. And when you project that out from your heart, Bruce Lipton talks about this too, right? Bruce Lipton, Greg Braden, Joe Dispenza, the three tenors of the science world, right? Mm-hmm. They talk about shifting that when you go from your heart, how it changes that vibration throughout the world. And so we send, with intention, laughter for peace and love and harmony. First of all, starting from ourselves and taking it into Oroville, to India, to around the world, and into this vibratory space wherever we are. Will you join me?
Absolutely. Okay. I'll give it a try.
Okay, and on that note, Hamish, Sri Priya, please join us. Thank you, Sri Priya. Thank you, Hamish.
Thank you all.
This is Oroville Radio, voices from the city of Dome.